When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
While the world whizzes by, enjoy a moment of me time with Tim Horton's $6 breakfast bundle. Savor a small hot or iced coffee, then add your choice of a mouth-watering hot breakfast sandwich and a crispy golden hash brown and your pick of a classic donut.
Yeah,
all for $6, all just for you. Make your mornings all about me time with our $6 breakfast bundle. Available at your neighborhood Tim Horton's. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
And we are back. Crossover NBA podcast, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck. And Howard, we are right around, I think, the 2-year mark of doing this podcast. So in that spirit, if you decide to leave the podcast tomorrow and go to another podcast, I will arrange for a video tribute when you come back to this podcast, because I was watching Nets Celtics over the weekend, and I noted Brooklyn gave Blake Griffin a video tribute when he returned. Blake Griffin, who spent 2 years in Brooklyn, well, it was kind of, I think, a year and a half, played a total of 82 games with the Nets. If you want to break it down to minutes, 1,500 minutes. I'm looking at some of his raw statistics right now. He scored, he took 502 field goal attempts in that time. He did not have a meaningful impact on the Brooklyn Nets, yet the Nets saw it justified to give him a video tribute. We goof around all the time about video tributes, Howard. That might have been rock bottom for me right there to see a Blake Griffin video tribute in Brooklyn.
Well, let's just say that if I were to leave this podcast and then came back for a guest appearance or something, the least you could do is give me a video tribute. The least you could do. I would be touched. I feel like it's only appropriate. But I will tell you, as you're mocking the Blake Griffin tribute, I was there for that moment. It was very moving, very meaningful, very heartfelt. The whole building, I think, was very emotional. Mm. That's not even the most ludicrous video tribute of the day, because the Washington Wizards gave one to Thomas Bryant of the Lakers. Now, granted, Thomas Bryant had 4 years in Washington, whereas Blake Griffin only had two in Brooklyn. But Blake Griffin actually was a key part of a Nets team that in the playoffs, for a moment, it looked like they might beat the Bucks and make a run to the finals. He actually played a significant role on an important team, whereas Thomas Bryant, I don't mean to pick on him, and he had some injuries while he was there, but 4 completely forgettable seasons with the Wizards, including the last 2 in which he only played 37 games combined. So, this goes back to my general feeling that we need rules on these things. We need rules for what qualifies you for a video tribute. And I think at minimum, you have to have been part of something memorable. Something. Blake Griffin barely makes it on the Nets one. Thomas Bryant with the Wizards. I can't get there. I'm sorry.
There are no rules for this. It's the Wild West out there. And I know there have been stories written about the video tribute, some very good ones, but I just really would like to know what goes into the thinking in the front offices of Brooklyn and Washington.
I'll tell you what goes into it. pandering. That's what goes into it. We need to make it look like we are the most player-friendly organization on earth. We want the agents to remember. We want the players to remember so that the next time we go to sign somebody, they feel that much better about us by some tiny percentage point.
Well,
it's
the
silly.
The screen grab of Blake Griffin that was going around showed a bemused Blake Griffin at seeing his face at a video tribute being thrown up on the Jumbotron for him. But we'll see. I'm sure we'll be talking about this at some point when there's another bizarre.
Oh, there'll be more.
There'll be more.
There'll be one that they'll be get more absurd by the day.
Yeah. All right. On this episode, we are going to discuss the Pelicans as a potential contender in the West. Are they there yet? Some dissension in the ranks in Atlanta between the head coach and the star player, and the ongoing debate about the best duo in the NBA. The twosome up in Boston, are they the best in the league? We'll get into that as well. But Howard, a lot of people, you know, begrudgingly on podcasts say they're going to talk about the Lakers. I don't do it. I love talking about the Lakers. They're fascinating, and people are interested. So I'll talk about the Lakers every time they do something interesting. And the Lakers are doing something interesting right now that makes them worthy of leading off this episode of the show. The Lakers started the season at 2-10. Since then, they have won 8 of their last 10. They are just a game out, as we record this, of the final play-in spot of the Western Conference. So they've made up quite a bit of ground. Anthony Davis is playing like an MVP, recently named the NBA's Player of the Week. He put up 99 points in back-to-back games against Milwaukee and Washington. Russell Westbrook, to his credit, settling in nicely to this sixth man role. I was looking up some of the numbers. Since he moved to the bench, he's shooting better than 34% from three. That's a great number for Russell Westbrook. That would be, I think, a career-high number for Russell Westbrook. The defense over the last 10, 11 games has been a top-10 level defense. Now, the flip side of the coin is that the Lakers have been racking up these wins and compiling these numbers largely against bad teams. The Milwaukee win, great one. By far the Lakers' best win of the season. That was a game that the Bucks had Chris Middleton back for. So they were at or close to full strength for that game. And the Lakers still found a way to win behind 55 points. Was it 49? One of the games, 44 points from Anthony Davis. The rest of the schedule, though, not been great. They have 3 wins over San Antonio during this stretch. They beat up on the Wizards, who played without Bradley Beal for most of that game. So, as we record this right now, Howard, do you consider the Lakers back in the contender mix, or do you need to see more?
I guess I have to answer your question with a question, Chris, which is contender for what exactly?
I would say a contender to make, to advance past the first round. Let's say that.
Okay. Because when we normally, when we say contender as shorthand, we mean contender for the championship, to which I would say, are you freaking kidding me? No.
Yeah, they're not, with 10 play-in spots, I don't want to say are they a contender. Yeah. I mean, you can be really mediocre and be a contender for a play-in. I would say, are they a contender to be a team that can win a first round series against a likely top four team?
Let's say a team that matters, right? A team that matters. If you're a one round and out, you don't really matter that much. And if you're not making the playoffs at all, you obviously don't. So are they a contender to be something significant? It's really jarring to think about where we were even 2 weeks ago versus where we are today with the Lakers. And to see even just Anthony Davis's performance over the first couple weeks of the season versus the last week or so. And even Anthony Davis right now, what we've seen the last several games versus, I don't know, the last couple of years in which the Lakers have been waiting for the guy who they thought would be a future perennial MVP candidate to reemerge. And here he is. Will it last? Russ has been solid as a sixth man, the most expensive sixth man in NBA history, but solid. How long would that last? Health issues for everybody. Well, how long would they last? I think this is a very encouraging revival. I have doubts about its sustainability, but I want to actually start with just putting in perspective what we've seen over the last couple of weeks. They have won 8 of 10, yes. But, real quick, in case anybody wasn't paying close enough attention, the first win in that series is against a Brooklyn team that at the time had a losing record, no Kyrie that game, no Ben Simmons that game. And I think maybe still a couple role players out too. So they beat the Nets. Then they beat Detroit, one of the worst teams in the NBA. They then proceed to beat the Spurs three straight games. The Spurs, who are going to be one of the, at best, one of the two worst teams in the NBA. Then they beat Portland without Dame Lillard. Then they beat Milwaukee last Friday. Now, that was an eye-opener. That was an eye-opener. That was significant, and that was on the road, and you cannot possibly diminish that, even if you think, oh, the Bucks were readjusting to getting Chris Middleton back that night. I think that's the best you could say.
Middleton played pretty well in that game for
sure.
His first game
back. So legitimate, substantial win. And then the last in the 8 out of 10, winning 8 out of 10, the last one of those before we record this podcast was them beating the Wizards in Washington. You know, the Wizards, not a great team. So out of
And Beal played, 3 minutes in that game. So
yeah, and Beal got hurt 3 minutes in.
Yeah.
So you've got 8 out of 10, just asterisked to death. One really good win against the Bucks, and everything else is either caveated or a really crappy team. To be good in this team, in this league, you have to first start beating the bad teams. So congratulations to the Lakers. They're now at least back to beating bad teams, which is the first step toward being able to beat good to great teams. The two losses in that 8 out of 10, by the way, were to Phoenix, a good team that they would have to go through to try to win the West, and Indiana, a revived team that is not great, though. So those are the two losses there. So let's see. They're still on this road trip where they're going to have to go to Cleveland, Toronto, and Philly. When they get home, they're going to play Boston and Denver. I think the true measure is still to come here, but it is encouraging, and it's the best we've seen, the most encouraging we've seen from them in quite a while. Look, LeBron's still playing at an all-NBA level. That's phenomenal. I'm not surprised. When healthy, that's what he does. But they still don't... Look, the things that we all flagged, Chris, in the preseason, that scouts flagged, that rivals flagged, not enough shooting, not enough perimeter defense, not enough size next to Anthony Davis. Those things have not changed. The roster is still flawed. So if Anthony Davis can play like an MVP night in, night out, it will possibly negate some of those deficiencies in the roster, but I don't know how sustainable that is. I'm intrigued. This is why we love sports. We have no idea when something like this kind of turnaround can come. So it's fun, but I just don't know what to believe right now.
Yeah, you point out the schedule, and that's the big, you know, spotlight for me, because of the bad teams that they have played and the teams they've got coming up. Like, If we're recording this next week and the Lakers have swept their way through Cleveland, Toronto, Philadelphia, Detroit on the back end of that, headed home to face Boston and Denver, it's a different conversation altogether, because then they would have romped through this road trip and you'd have to really consider them more than just playoff contenders, first round contenders. Then you have to start talking about them as being able to get it together as potential conference contenders. I love what I'm seeing from Anthony Davis. I feel like the last couple of years, we've kind of not pigeonholed Anthony Davis, but kind of looked at him closely and said he's got to be the best defensive player in the league. He's got to be defensive player of the year for this Lakers team to be successful. No, Anthony Davis at his best is arguably the best player in the league still. Like, he can be that. He has that talent within him. You know, and we've seen that talent over the last week. What I love about Davis's play is that he's gotten away from the jump shot a lot more than he used to be. His three-point numbers the last 10, 11 games are way down from what they've been in previous seasons. And last year, that shot was a big problem for him. That was one of the reasons he deteriorated overall as a player. To see him going to the basket, finishing at the rim, embracing his physicality, you know, that makes Anthony Davis a lot more dangerous. The other things you like, too, is it seems like everybody's shooting the ball pretty well right now. The Lakers as a team right now still rank in the bottom third of the league in three-point shooting. But over the last like 10 games, you got guys like Lonnie Walker shooting the jumper really well. Russell Westbrook shooting the jumper really well. I wonder how sustainable that is. You know, if you're going to get all these guys shooting high 30s, low 40s from three-point range like these guys have done in recent weeks. So you don't fault the Lakers for beating up on the teams they're beating up on. This isn't college football or college basketball. You play the team that the NBA schedules you to play. You play everybody. This is just a stretch where they're playing bizarrely, the San Antonio Spurs three times in like 10 days. But I want to see more over the next 2 weeks. But if, like, AD apparently, you know, based on all the reporting, his back injury, he's moved past the most difficult part of that. Always will be something to watch with him. But if he's healthy, this should not be considered an aberration. Like, I don't expect him to get 99 points in back-to-back games, but can he average 25 to 30 with 10 to 15 rebounds, 4 or 5 blocks? Yeah, that's within him to do that. LeBron is still capable of being LeBron. Westbrook, we're kind of reaching the point where you almost expect this off-the-bench Westbrook to continue. He still has his bizarre moments, and when they lose, it's not all his fault, but sometimes he just winds up taking some bizarre shots in the fourth quarter. But I'm starting to believe that Westbrook off the bench can be a net positive for this team, whereas I never believed that last season and the early stage of this season. So I'm going to give it one more week. I'm going to say, I don't know. I'm going to say no to I don't know right now. But a week from now, when they get through the last four games of this road trip, if they have the same success they've had in the first couple of games, I'll be ready to buy in altogether.
So I think the really interesting thing about this is, if you recall, in the early part of the season when the Lakers were just abysmal, and the question was to make the Russ trade plus the two picks or not, and the calculus was based on this idea for the Lakers that, well, we don't want to make the deal that sends out the two future first-round picks, these golden tickets potentially, unless it's going to make us a contender. And that was laughable at the time, because the idea that sending out Russ and a couple of picks for whoever, Hield and Turner or whatever it was going to be, was not nearly going to be enough to make them a true contender for a title run, a deep playoff run. So the question now, Chris, is if we believe what we're seeing right now, if this is who they really are, and granted, you and I have just listed all the potential caveats, does this then open the door further, in fact, for a Russ deal? Like, one position would be, well, no, things are going pretty well. Don't mess with it. Russ is actually settling in nicely as the sixth man. Just let this thing go. Anthony Davis going to play at this level combined with LeBron. We're in business. We don't have enough shooting and role players, but whatever, we'll be fine. You could take that, or you could say this was the turning point or the kind of play you were looking for to say, wait a minute, maybe we are one trade away. So I'll throw it back to you. If you're Rob Pelinka, and you see them playing this way, and if they sustain it through the rest of this road trip, let's say they beat at least Boston or Denver. They're probably not beating both of them. They may not beat either of them. But let's say this encouraging run continues and they beat at least a couple of other good teams along the way. Does this actually make the case for trading Russ for Hield and Turner or whatever the equivalent is? Because now it is, oh, hey, plug a couple of holes, get some more shooting. We actually are in business.
Yeah, it's a tough question. I would say that if they're successful over the next couple of weeks, it's probably going to be because Russ has continued to play well. And if you're trading away a guy that's playing well, a guy that's really performed well in that sixth man role for two guys that are, you know, good fits in that starting lineup, I'm not sure how much better you're going to get. It's bizarre that I keep using the word bizarre, but it really is watching the Lakers. It's crazy having this conversation because 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, you know, Russell Westbrook was a liability with this team. He was a complete net negative. Now he's contributing. He's making perimeter shots. He's making good decisions. He's fit well in that second unit. As we record this right now, I don't know how much better the Lakers would be swapping Westbrook for Hield Turner. And that was a debate even before this recent run of success has been for the Lakers. People are like, well, you don't make that trade and give up two firsts if you're not going to get that much better. Now I think it's even less likely, Howard, that you make a deal like that. Maybe you're now looking to make something fringier, but as we pointed out, the Lakers don't have a lot of salary to move to make them better. Like, they're not going to be a player for like Kelly Olynyk in the next couple of weeks because they're not trading away a future first round pick to go and get him.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I don't know that I want to bank on Westbrook being great in this role for the rest of the season. I don't know that I want to
18 games.
It's a lot. I don't know how much I trust that. I still think that if you're the Lakers overall, if it's a really expensive but fairly effective Russ as sixth man versus two high-level rotation players, again, let's say it's Miles Turner and Buddy Hield, the deal that, you know, they could have had over the summer and maybe still can, if I'm going to get the shot-blocking center who can also shoot threes and the elite three-point shooter who could play guard, I still think they're better off with that, because those two combined with this version of Anthony Davis and what LeBron already is, like, now you are in business. And I think whatever you're giving up on the playmaking off the bench, whatever, you can find another sixth man. You can find a much cheaper sixth man. You'll figure out how to plug the hole that Westbrook leaves. He's not the Westbrook of old. You're not. This is not like you're giving up an all-star. I still think you're better off fortifying your shooting, your spacing, your shot blocking, everything you would get in that deal. And again, I don't know if this hot streak, 8 out of 10, mostly against bad teams, justifies making that kind of move in a way that the Lakers did not feel was going to be justified before. But it's really made it a more interesting question for them, I think.
It absolutely has. I do think it makes it less likely that they move those two first-round picks, or at least attach them to Westbrook to get Hield and Turner. I don't think it there's going to be a belief in that Laker front office that the deal makes them that much better, that it's worth giving up that kind of capital for the future. But again, this is...
And the Pacers aren't going to do it without those picks.
Exactly.
So.
Look, this is certainly a conversation we'll revisit maybe as soon as next week, if they have success.
And the week after, and after.
We might be leading the podcast with that again. All right, if you look at the Western Conference standings right now, the Phoenix Suns sit in first place. Not a huge surprise there. The Suns, great regular season team last year. Right below them, Howard, the New Orleans Pelicans. 15-8 to start the season. Third best point differential in the NBA. Second best point differential in the Western Conference. They're getting contributions from everywhere. CJ McCollum has been really strong. You saw Jose Alvarado have a career game the other night. Zion Incredible. Williamson is playing well. Trey Murphy. I was just talking to Tony Bennett, the head coach of Virginia, the other day. Great run for Tony Bennett's guys. Sam Hauser in Boston, Trey Murphy in New Orleans. He's been a sniper for them beyond the three-point line. You look at some of the numbers, and the Pelicans are up there in some very key categories. Offensive rating, sixth. Defensive rating, third. Net rating, fourth. They're top five in points per game, field goal percentage, steals per game, overall plus minus. These are numbers that scream contender at you, Howard. They're not really weak in any particular area. So I'll ask you this. Coming into this season, the Pelicans, I think a playoff berth would have been a satisfactory outcome to this season. Is this a team that right now is built for more?
Yeah, I mean, listen, in this conversation about contender, I think we're now using the C word to mean title contender. I thought that the Pelicans had a really good shot to be a top six team, a legit playoff team, not a play-in team, before the season started. I was pretty bullish on them, but not so bullish that I thought they had the chance to be top four in the West. But the West has gotten really weird and really fluid, right? It's wide open. The Suns are the tops in the West, but not by a very wide margin. The Nuggets are hanging around, and they're right there. The Grizzlies are right there. The Warriors have recovered. The Clippers, just before we started recording this, the Clippers are getting Kawhi Leonard and Paul George back for the 8 billionth time. We'll see how long it lasts this time. But there's a lot of potential candidates to win the West, or at least make a run to the conference finals in the West. And the Pelicans are now in that group. They are absolutely, positively, legitimately in that group. So when you say, are they a contender? So here's all the ways in which I would identify, like, can you define this team as a contender? Do they have at least one top 10 guy and or multiple all-stars? Yeah, they do. Zion at his best is a top 10 player. CJ McCollum and Brandon Ingram are all-star or all-star caliber players. They've got three stars on this team. So yes, they've got the fundamental high-level talent. Are you at least a 50-win team? Because teams don't win titles usually from the 40 range. Yeah, they're on pace for 53 wins. So that checks. Top 10 defense is almost a must, as we know historically. As you noted, they're top three in defensive rating. They're behind only Cleveland and Milwaukee in defense, which is astounding. I don't think that's anything people expected from the Pelicans. Top 10 offense, they're sixth behind Boston, Phoenix, Utah, Sacramento, and Denver. Their offense currently ranking ahead of the Warriors, Grizzlies, and Mavericks. And then the last thing is, you know, if you're going to make a deep playoff run, you got to have somebody who can create and deliver in the clutch. Yeah, all three of their guys can create. Zion, CJ McCollum, Brandon Ingram. Any of those guys can get you out of a jam and manufacture points. So, yeah, I mean, listen, like, they're checking every box, and they've got some great defenders. The only thing I would, if you're trying to find the reason why they wouldn't be able to make a run to the finals, the only thing I can come up with is, you know, there's not a ton of playoff experience, right? This will be more of an issue when we're discussing them in April than right now. But just as a preview of that, Zion Williamson, zero playoff games in his career. Brandon Ingram, six. CJ McCollum's got 63. Jonas Valanciunas, 54. Larry Nance Jr., 26. But like Trey Murphy, Herb Jones, Alvarado, like these guys, like there's no real postseason experience here. So I wouldn't expect a deep run necessarily. But man, like the West is just wide open right now. And I don't know if it's going to get very uncluttered over the course of the season. I think all these teams are kind of evenish.
I know the other thing too is they're really deep. Like you just mentioned a bunch of guys. Like I didn't even mention Herb Jones. I didn't mention Brandon Ingram, even though he's been great this
season.
They're
very
deep. They you look at some of their bench statistics this year. I was looking at them before we started the show. I mean, they're top five when it comes to plus minus with their second unit. Their bench put up big numbers. Like they've got guys that they can go to. 9-10 guys that are legitimate NBA players. And that's valuable. I think, you know, obviously we get to the playoffs, the rotations tighten a little bit, but this is a team I think that has some staying power, at least the regular season. Then we'll see. We'll see what happens there. Ingram, though, like when I watch Pelicans games, like Ingram, you mentioned guys in the clutch. Ingram seems to be the guy they go to most often in the clutch, and he's had a lot of success. His clutch numbers are really good. And he's been slowly over these last couple of years really establishing himself as an elite scorer. His three-point numbers this year are wild. I mean, three-point numbers across the board in the league. He's shooting, I think, high 40s from three-point range, something like that. If he can keep this progress up, and he's still a young guy, he could be that go-to guy in the playoffs. I mean, McCollum has experience. He can make shots. Zion's a star. But I think you're going to need Ingram, who's like that Kevin Durant-like player in terms of physical frame and skill set. You need him to be the guy, I think, in the postseason. I think he's shown through the first 20-25 games of this season that there's that potential there. He can be that guy for this team.
For sure. For sure. I mean, Brandon Ingram's already been, you know, he's been an all-star. He's got a lot of tools in the toolbox, as they say. There's a versatility there and a creativity there. He's not the guy who necessarily is like, get me the ball every time. I'm just going to go like, you know, drop 30, 40 tonight. He's capable of it. He's not, I don't know he's necessarily built that way in terms of his, you know, like, I don't know that you want to do that with him, but you don't have to do that with him. You know, like this is a super turbocharged version of an ensemble cast, right? Like Zion Williamson does have top 10 potential, and CJ McCollum and Brandon Ingram are both really, really good players who can be an all-star on the all-star team in any given year. But it is kind of like the overall spread of talent and number of different ways you can go with this team that makes them, I think, so dangerous. And yes, for sure, the depth, they've got a lot going for them, and they've come along, I think, more quickly than people thought they might. And I certainly thought it might take some time for them to figure out the pecking order or the distribution between those three stars with Zion coming back to this team. CJ McCollum just got there in February. So they don't have a lot of time together, but I think they're showing pretty great chemistry for a team that's still pretty new to each other.
Shout out to David Griffin for building this team. I mean, we say all the time, like it's not just about hitting on those top two, three picks. I mean, Zion was a no-brainer a few years ago. Brandon Ingram, who they got in the trade for AD, was the number two pick a few years before that. It's getting Herb Jones in the second round. It's getting Trey Murphy. It's getting these guys that fill out the roster spots around them that fill the roles. Herb Jones, one of the best defensive wings in the NBA. Trey Murphy shooting above 40% from three. I mean, this is how you build championship level teams. And David Griffin has proven once again he's well equipped to do that.
Alvarado's undrafted, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Like, and by the way, they still have all those future picks from the Lakers. Like, they're getting
they can do
a swap.
Something. They're dangerous in a trade. I don't want to get into that at this point, but like if they wanted to, they could go make a play for a big fish that becomes available.
And they don't have to, but like, let's say they've got an injury, or let's say they've got a chance to just grab. They can get greedy, grab one more all-star. Who knows? Yeah. Upgrade at center, whatever it is. If they need something, they have all the tools in the world because they still have all these future firsts and swaps from the Lakers. They've got a future first from Milwaukee. That's from the Drew Holiday trade. Oh, two future firsts from Milwaukee still. Is it three? I think they still have all three and swaps. They've just got
a
boatload of stuff, and I think they still have all their own picks too. So like they're in great shape to make whatever moves they need to if they need to spend a pick here or there.
Yeah, I mean,
Griff has done a phenomenal job.
The Lakers got AD and they got a championship. And as we pointed out, AD, when he's healthy, is still one of the best players in the NBA. But it goes without saying that the Pelicans do that trade 10 times out of 10. You know, 7 days a week and twice on Sunday.
I'm going to say it one more time. I wrote it at the time. Yeah. The Lakers won the trade and lost the negotiation.
They did. They got a title. Can't take that away from them. But
nope.
Pelicans are going to be a force for years to come. All right. Little bit of an issue going on right now in Atlanta. The Hawks sitting at 13-10, right in the middle of the Eastern Conference playoff field. But The Athletic reported over the last few days that Trae Young and Nate McMillan may not be on the same page. What it comes down to was that Nate McMillan wanted Trae Young to participate in a shoot-around. Trae Young preferred to just continue with treatment on his injury. According to The Athletic, Nate McMillan effectively said, you can either come participate in shoot-around or you can go home and not come. Trae Young elected not to go to the game that night. The Hawks won that game against Denver. I don't want to overreact too much to, you know, minor infighting within a locker room, because you and I both probably hear stuff like this all the time. Coach doesn't get along with player. Player doesn't get along with coach. There's a lot of this that happens behind the scenes, whether it's in film sessions or shoot-arounds. Disagreements can happen from time to time, especially with strong-willed people like Trae Young and Nate McMillan. But it did happen, and it's out there, and Trae Young was forced to respond to it on Monday. He effectively said, people don't understand the real story. We're going to keep it private, yada, yada, yada. But as you read the situation, Howard, with the information that we have, how concerning is this for the Atlanta Hawks?
This is not a five-alarm fire, but it's not great. We know that Trae Young, his clashes with or lack of ability to really vibe with Lloyd Pierce, caused Lloyd Pierce's firing a few years ago before they hired Nate McMillan. So he's on his second coach. And, that's not unusual for young stars in the NBA. They usually go through one or two before they get to the guy who they really connect with and have their best years with. But still, Trae Young has been known to be kind of a tough nut at times. Has certainly been a challenge for coaches at times and for teammates at times. All of that has been known around the league since early on. He's 24, Trey, and in his fifth season, this is when you hope a guy is kind of trying, is able to kind of figure it out and calibrate themselves and be their best selves. And, I don't know. Since we don't have a lot of detail right now, it's not clear, is this just a miscommunication? Was this him kind of sulking? Was this Nate McMillan's doing more than Trae Young's? And we haven't heard from, as you and I record this, Nate McMillan hasn't spoken yet today. Trae Young has. Mm. So I don't know where to put this other than it's something to keep an eye on, right? Like the Hawks have kind of not flatlined, they've plateaued, I should say. They made that conference finals run ahead of time. Maybe that went to some guys' heads. This is a team that's still trying to figure out what to do with John Collins. like, the John Collins trade watch has been going on since, like, I don't know, the Taft administration. It's been a long time. And so there's just, I think, some, just some weirdness there. And I'm not sure where that goes.
Yeah. The clip of Trae Young having the back and forth with the reporter in Atlanta has kind of made the rounds at this point.
Yeah.
And I didn't mind the reporter's questions. I mean, I thought they were good questions. In fact, Trae Young, maybe, we don't know exactly what happened behind the scene, but the fact is Trae Young was not at the game against Denver. And, even when you're injured, most players, certainly players of Trae Young's caliber, are expected to be there and be supportive of your team. And he did not do that for whatever reason. And I think there does need to be a level of accountability there. If you're, the leader of that franchise, the face of that franchise, you've got to be better than that. I think that's what it comes down to. The bigger concern for me is that Trae Young is not having a good year. I mean, you look at the numbers, and he's averaging, close to 28 points per game. But go take a deeper dive into them, and it's ugly out there, Howard. He's shooting career lows from three-point range and career lows from the floor. He's putting up more shots than he has at any point in his career, and missing more than he has, at least at a higher percentage. So, this is a problem. And I watched bits and pieces of that Nuggets game, and DeJounte Murray was great in that game. Like, he was awesome. I think he had 34 points, 8 assists, played great. And that ball was kind of moving around for Atlanta in that one. That was a good game for them. One of their better wins of the season. Trey's got to kind of figure it out. I mean, this team right now, officially in the middle of the pack in the Eastern Conference, but I if you want to create tiers, it's Boston, Milwaukee, and it's everybody else. And there's a big gap between Boston, Milwaukee, and the Atlanta Hawks right now. And look, I think the Hawks, during that conference finals run, they had a measure of luck. They won their series, no question about it, but Kevin Herter needed to play great in that game 7 against Philadelphia, and that was a lot about the Sixers and how they kind of imploded in that series. So, if I'm Trae Young, I've got to get my mind right. I've got to get my game right here, because the numbers don't lie. He's averaging almost 28 points per game, but the shooting numbers are abysmal at this point. And for this Hawks team to be a true finals contender, he's got to be right up there in the 46% range, 47% range from the field as he was a year ago. He's got to be high 30s, even low 40s from three-point range. And he's got to figure out a way to gel with DeJounte Murray, which I don't think has really happened at the way the Hawks needed to happen yet.
Well, that's the concern, right? Because in the offseason, I think most people, not everybody, but most people liked the move for DeJounte Murray. Most people liked the idea of it. DeJounte Murray is going to come in, take some of the playmaking burdens off, allow Trae Young to be perhaps even more dangerous as a shooter off the ball, certainly provide a lot of backcourt defense that Trae Young does not provide. And then, of course, when Trae Young's on the bench, you've got DeJounte Murray to take up those minutes and still have elite playmaking out there. I'm always curious when you get two guys of that caliber together, and this is the same thing with Donovan Mitchell and Darius Garland or any combinations like this, how do guys manage the kind of the shot distribution, right? Trae Young's usage rate is unchanged. So I don't know if that's necessarily something to worry about or not, but you would have thought that both guys would have come down a little bit as they learn how to kind of share the responsibilities. So there's that. You noted career low 30% from three, career low 46% from two. He's not being as efficient, and I don't know. I haven't gone deeper into it to look. Is he just not taking the best shots for him? Is he forcing it a little bit? Is this part of the discomfort of sharing responsibilities with DeJounte? So now when he does get the ball, he's forcing shots that he shouldn't be taking. I'm not exactly sure where that lies, but you would hope. The ideal, of course, is that he has his best year and his most efficient year getting another top-level ball handler and scorer next to him. It shouldn't bring him down. It should make his life easier. So that, again, that's a warning flag to me. And then, of course, behind all of this. Eventually, we get to this is making the Luka trade debate spicier every day. So,
there's plenty of time to right the ship in Atlanta. They have had the injuries. Yes. John Collins has been hurt. DeAndre Hunter has been hurt. Now Trae Young is hurt. But I boil it down to this. I'm more concerned with the way Trae Young is shooting the ball than I am with any disagreement with Nate McMillan. Like, Nate McMillan is a very kind of in-your-face type of guy. I'm sure yes. Nate's had, you know, go back to the Seattle days. Nate's, I'm sure, had plenty of confrontations with star players. It happens in this league from time to time. But Trae Young's game, that's concerning, the way his shooting has slipped during the season. All right, I want to finish with a topic that's come up, you know, a little bit in the last couple of months. Best duo in the NBA right now. It was back in October that Paul Pierce labeled Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown as the best duo in the NBA. A little bit biased.
The always objective Paul Pierce.
Always objective Paul Pierce. Shout out to Paul Pierce. But a month later, Luka Doncic, after playing in Boston, said Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum were the best duo in the NBA. I'll put it to you. You look across the league, is there a twosome that you would rather have more than Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown?
So on the list of things I never think about unless we're doing it on the podcast, this is right up there. So I did the exercise earlier today, and I just kind of went through the league, and I said, who could I possibly put there? So here's the list of twosomes that definitely are not better than them, but that I at least thought about, you know, kind of great, but have some deficiency that keeps them off of their level. By the way, this entire discussion, I'm not even going to talk about the Paolo Banchero Bull Bull tandem yet, because I don't think people can handle that quite yet. But
no,
you know, put a pin on that one. We'll come back to them one of these weeks. Donovan Mitchell, Darius Garland, Donovan Mitchell. Defense not there, size issues. So throw them over. You know, throw them to the side. Tatum and Brown obviously better than them. Dame and Anthony Simons great, but again, defense and size problems. Anthony Edwards, Karl Anthony Towns, we've already seen there are some chemistry issues there. And again, defense, a problem. Put them to the side. We talked about Trae Young and DeJounte Murray. Nice tandem, but defense, a problem. Chemistry, possibly an issue. Zion and Ingram, yeah, you know, like very good, potent, but not at that level. Ja Morant, Desmond Bain. Bain plays defense. Ja, not as much. A very great young tandem, but still, they don't have the size that Brown and Tatum do. Jimmy Butler, Bam Adebayo. Two-way players, pretty nice 1-2 punch, but not the offensive capabilities. So put them to the side. Paul George and Kawhi Leonard should be high on this list, but you cannot put them on anything until those guys are healthy for more than 5 minutes in a row. So then you've got these guys, you've got some tandems where it's like the first guy is so great that it doesn't matter who the second guy is. Like, is Jokic so great that it doesn't matter whether Jamal Murray is back to where he's supposed to be? Giannis and Middleton, Booker, and I guess Chris Paul is the second guy there now, right? Like, we've inverted that. And I'm still going to say that Brown and Tatum are, because of their two-way abilities, their offensive firepower, their length, I think are better than those three tandems that I just mentioned. Even though those tandems are, one of them involves Jokic and one involves Giannis, who between them have four straight MVPs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't.
So
think
at least it leaves me with three tandems that you could potentially challenge them with. Number one, Kevin Durant, Kyrie Irving. Now, Kevin Durant is still an elite player in this league, still a top whatever you want to make it, and is just an offensive machine. You've got a ton of shot making and shot creation with these two. Durant can defend at a high level. Kyrie, when motivated, when focused, will defend. But they also got smoked by the Celtics and Tatum and Brown. So I'm going to put them off to the side. Embiid and Harden. Embiid's a perennial MVP candidate. Harden, his playoff resume is just so horrific, and he doesn't defend. So I got to put them off to the side. That leaves me with one potential tandem that could challenge Tatum and Brown, and it's the tandem that we talked about at the top of the show. How about that Lakers-Celtics rivalry? LeBron and AD, at least as of the last five games, you might have a discussion.
LeBron and AD, because of this past week, were really the only ones. And I had the same list as you did there. I was a little maybe more bullish on Zion and Ingram, but that may be recency bias as well because we discussed them playing extremely well. AD playing like an MVP. LeBron still being pretty close to LeBron of old. You know, the question with them is reliability, right? Like, we've seen AD do it over a week, 10 days. Let me see him do it over 2 months to 3 months and get back to being at that level. Because of that, I don't think it's that close. I think Tatum and Brown are the best duo in the NBA by a lot at this moment. They're both dynamic offensive players. Jason Tatum might finish this season as the best offensive player in the NBA, certainly top two or three in the NBA. He's probably going to average over 30 points per game this season. He's diversified his offense. He's gotten more physical with his offense. The free throw numbers have gone up this year. He is a great offensive player and a vastly improved defensive player. He's probably never going to be elite in the defensive category, but over the last couple of years, and I've watched him a lot, he's really improved. He's really started to use his tools to the best of his abilities, right? He's really long. He can move his feet a little bit. He's got good instincts. He's done that. So he's become an above average defensive player. Jaylen Brown, better defensive player than Jason Tatum, can defend multiple positions. And offensively, like, Jaylen Brown could do it all too. Like, there's nothing, I mean, I wouldn't say there's nothing that Jason Tatum could do that Jaylen Brown can't, but look at some of the numbers that Jaylen Brown puts up when Jason Tatum's out of the lineup. Like, I think it was Charlotte, right? I think it was Charlotte they played against. When Jason Tatum was out and Brown went for like 36 in that game. In the games of the last couple of seasons that Tatum has missed and Brown has played in, he's averaging better than 30 points per game. So Jaylen Brown, credit to him, has, you know, kind of been willing to take a step back a little bit offensively when he's playing with Tatum. But when he's not, you can see him just taking off. Tatum is a top five MVP player right now, period, full stop. Jaylen Brown, you know, all-star lock at the moment, but he's making a strong case in the first month and a half that he's going to get consideration for all NBA. And when you've got two guys doing that type of stuff, putting up 50, 60 points per game, defending at a good level, being available in the way that Tatum and Brown are available on the court, there's a gap, Howard, between them and everybody else for all those reasons for the best duo in the league. I don't think it's, at the moment, I don't think it's all that close.
Yeah, no, for the sake of argument, the LeBron AD thing is really interesting because LeBron is still playing at an elite level.
Yes.
And Anthony Davis has gotten back to the guy that we saw flashes of in years past. You got to sustain it longer, for sure. I think, listen, if they do this for, you know, the next month, then you've got a real debate between the two tandems because Anthony Davis, by virtue of his size, provides something that the two Celtics cannot, right? There's a rim protection factor there and a versatility in terms of the kinds of now, Brown and Tatum can guard a bunch of different guys, but they're probably not guarding Joel Embiid. Anthony Davis probably would prefer not to guard Joel Embiid. But I think by virtue of the size of LeBron and Anthony Davis, I could make a stronger case for them. But if they continue this, right, they've got to do this for more than, you know, 8 out of 10 games against mostly bad competition. So fair determination. As of right now, Tatum and Brown is the best tandem in the NBA. I wouldn't argue it.
All right, Howard, I'm going to go work on your video tribute. But I'm sure next week we'll be back talking Lakers once again.
I look forward to seeing my video. A lot of highlights to choose from. Hope you've got a good editor there, and we'll see you next week.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.